Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, September 24th. For today's podcast, highlights from last night's national call-in show, America, Are We Ready for Truth and Reconciliation?, about the racial reckoning this country is going through and what's needed to make it meaningful. I co-hosted with WNYC's Kai Wright, host of the podcast, The United States of Anxiety.
So tonight, Brian and I are inviting all of you into a sort of thought experiment on truth and reconciliation about systemic racism in the United States. If we're ever going to move forward, we will need some kind of shared truth. That seems like a necessary step to get any kind of real reconciliation, reconciling of debts. We're wondering, with so much water under the proverbial bridge, is it even possible to get to that kind of shared truth? We certainly hope so. And this is a national call-in, so we want to invite you to say what truths need to be told about American history or about the state of our country today. What do you think needs to be stated out loud for racial justice and reconciliation to really take place? And also, what truth do you need to tell about your own life or family history? What needs to be said out loud to eventually build some stronger civic bonds and maximize equality for our future? And as we take your calls and try to think about all the truth-telling that we need to do, we're joined by Dr. Keisha Blaine. She's a historian of 20th century America, focusing on Black history in particular at the University of Pittsburgh. She's the author of Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women and the Global Struggle for Freedom, and co-editor with Ibram Kendji of an upcoming collection called 400 Souls, a Community History of African America. And I should say I'm a contributor to that collection, very proudly so. Dr. Blaine, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in addition to all those things I just said about you, you're also the president of the African American Intellectual Historical Society, which kind of puts you in an interesting position, I think, to talk about the field broadly, you know? And so can we start there? It feels like history itself has become such a battleground in the political conversation right now. The president has openly attacked the 1619 Project from the New York Times, for instance, and there is, of course, sort of constant battle over public monuments. But I think maybe what non-historians might not know is that this has all kind of grown out of a movement within academia, it seems to me, led by both Black historians, but also others, to tell a different kind of history, a different kind of story about America's past. Where do you think that started in the field? Where would you put the beginning of that and where we're at now?
Well, the first thing that I would say is that having this conversation about history and how we tell our history, I'm mindful of the importance of Black historians because it certainly matters who tells the story. And it's not a dismissal on any particular race of people or any group. But it's to say that for such a long time, the way that Black history has been taught has been really framed as one that I think has really sidelined Black agency and even Black stories and Black ideas. And I think certainly what the African American Intellectual History Society is a part of is I think a larger movement, certainly not one that started, at this moment. I think this is something that we can trace back to individuals like Lerone Bennett. I've been thinking about him and his remarkable work as a writer, as a historian. We could talk about W.E.B. Du Bois much earlier. And so this is part of, I think, a long history and an effort by Black historians in particular to resist these kinds of narratives that tend to exclude us. And that's exactly why an organization like AIHS exists in the first place, is because we felt it was important to make sure that our voices were heard and that our histories were told accurately.
Haley in Atlanta. Haley, you're on America, Are We Ready? Hi there. What would you like to say?
Hi, Haley.
Do you want to speak a piece of historical truth that you think needs to be part of the conversation, or what would you like to add?
Yeah, Yeah, so I went to Georgia Public School, and I ended up going to do my undergrad in history. And one of the first books I read as an undergrad was Howard Zinn's The People's History of the U.S. And I just remember it being probably the most influential history book that I'd ever read in my life, the first chapter being about Columbus. And, you know, he's this revered character because in public education we have this system of American exceptionalism that's taught. And to hear these truths being told that I'd never heard before, I mean, it changed my paradigm. It changed everything I thought I knew. And it led me onto this journey of pursuing higher education and history. And so it's super important. And I'm really glad that these things are being discussed now, because it should be part of the conversation in K-12 around the nation.
Haley, thank you so much. Alan in Ithaca, New York, you're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I worked with Archbishop Tutu for a while. Before he began Truth and Reconciliation, he was my honorary chair since the early 90s. And the thing that I think that is not often articulated or understood is that together the mission is to reframe the importance of having a zero-sum game to one that's win-win. And in order to have a miraculous transition like they did in South Africa, those who are in power need to understand that, number one, they're not going to stay in power, because you can't subjugate a people in the way that they did with the numbers that they had forever. But number two, that there is a way forward in which they don't have to be absolute losers. And that's the only way to get the cooperative approach to the problem. And the way things are structured now, we continue to think that if somebody is winning, somebody else must be losing, and vice versa. And that's the game that we play.
Alan, thank you so much for that thought. Dr. Blaine, do you want to comment on that? Or do you see South Africa's truth and reconciliation process or anything from any other country as a model for us in any way?
Yes, I do think it is a model. But, you know, I think ultimately, before any change could happen, there has to be an open acknowledgement that there's a problem, right? And I think this is why we constantly find ourselves going around in circles in the United States, because we find ourselves with leaders, in this case, President Trump and others, who just keep denying racism, denying systemic racism, even to think about police brutality and violence, simply saying that it's not a problem and that these are just isolated incidents, and they don't want to acknowledge that this is a pattern of behavior. So before we can even imagine moving forward, we have to at least come to a place where we acknowledge this is a racist society, white supremacy still exists, and Black people and brown people in this country simply do not have the same opportunities, the same experiences as others. Once we do that, we can talk about real reconciliation.
Dr. Blaine, you mentioned violence in there. You have written and thought a lot about violence, anti-Black violence, both from the state and otherwise. And I guess I imagine for a lot of people right now, they're thinking about Breonna Taylor and the ruling that, the news today that there will be that there were no indictments in her killing. And I wonder on this issue specifically, what kind of truth from our history you think needs to be told? So on the specific question of police violence or specifically or violence against Black people generally, what is the truth that needs to be told about that if we're going to move forward?
Well, I think the truth is that when it comes to policing in the United States, the history goes directly back to the institution of slavery. And a lot of people don't want to acknowledge that, don't want to accept that, because doing so means that we can't have this constant conversation about reforming and changing and tweaking and fixing an institution that fundamentally comes out of a context where Black people were subjugated from the very beginning. How do you make a system supposedly work when it's rotten to its core. I mean, this is a question that activists are asking. It's a question I'm asking, and people don't really want to be honest with the answer, because then when we talk about defunding the police or we talk about abolition, people get uncomfortable. But we have to grapple with this, because the system itself, as I said, is rotten, and it comes out of a history of subjugation when it comes to black and brown people.
Let's take another phone call. Sharon in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. You're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, Sharon.
Yes. Hello, Brian. Thank you so much for the show. I'm the white mother of a biracial son. My ex-husband is from West Africa and Benin. I was in New York City, but I'm from central Pennsylvania, and I moved back. And this is what I'm going to say. We have to recognize that there is a problem. And in certain pockets of our country, such as in central Pennsylvania, you have a situation where you have my son's coach telling me that racism isn't a problem. That was about a year and a half ago, 2 years maybe. Now we are no longer friendly with one another. Things like this happen because we cannot come to the agreement that there is a problem. And even I have on both sides of me in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, I have two Trump supporters. And when it comes to a conversation with my neighbor, when it comes to bordering on politics, we actually have to say to each other, you know what? We both know we disagree, so there's really no point in discussing this matter any further in order to stay civil and friendly, you know? So the cognitive dissonance is immense, and I don't know how in the world. I see it in central Pennsylvania. I didn't see that in New York City.
And I'm going to move on for time. Thank you very much. Dr. Blaine, do you want to react?
Yes, I think one of the important things to remember here, is that the U.S. is a fairly young country, and I know that may sound odd to say, but it's true. Let's imagine that we are starting with 1776, as clearly some people would prefer that date as opposed to 1619. Fine. If we start there, it's important to remember that slavery was not abolished until 1865, right, with the 13th Amendment, the end of the Civil War. It's also important to acknowledge that the Civil Rights Act was not passed until 1964, the Voting Rights Act, 1965. We are in 2020. When people say to me, oh, it's not about race, or it's important for us to potentially, just think about unfairness, as the caller just said, I say to them, understand that it's always been about race. How do you have an entire nation built on the backs of black people, built on slavery, and then tell me in 2020, stop talking about race, stop talking about racism, it's just about injustice? No, it actually is about race. It absolutely is about racism, because we are still fairly young, and there are people who are still alive from the 1960s. We are not past this as we want to imagine. So I would just caution people to be mindful of the timeline here.
Presidential candidates talk very differently about history and systemic racism. We're doing this in the context of the presidential race. Here's Trump from a rally just the other day arguing that there is an attempt by some people in this country to analyze too much in the context of race, and he doesn't like how they analyze it either.
By viewing every issue through the lens of race, they want to impose a new segregation, and we must not allow that to happen. Critical race theory, the 1619 Project, and the crusade against American history is toxic propaganda, ideological poison that, if not removed, will dissolve the civic bonds that tie us together.
So he frames the problem as toxic propaganda, making too much of race and seeking to impose a new segregation, as he called it. That was interesting to me. That clip is Trump trying to pin the word segregation, of all words, on the people who are trying to analyze U.S. history in terms of, well, the segregation that has been a hallmark of it. Here is, as far as I've ever heard him go, to acknowledge systemic racism, and it's from those Bob Woodward tapes, the interviews that the journalist and the president did earlier this year for Woodward's new book. It begins with a Woodward question.
you think there is systematic or institutional racism in this country?
Well, I think there is everywhere. I think probably less here than most places or less here than many places.
Okay, but is it here in a way that it has an impact on people's lives?
I think it is, and it's unfortunate, but I think it is.
So different from most of his public language, Trump said to Woodward that systemic racism is everywhere and agrees that it's here in a way that has impact on people's lives. But it's something he says quietly, certainly not at his rallies. Here's Joe Biden making a brief general reference to history when he visited Kenosha recently after the shooting of Jacob Blake. He starts by referring to Trump's statement about Charlottesville in 2017 that there were good people on both sides.
It legitimizes the dark side of human nature. And what it did, though, it also exposed what had not been paid enough attention to, the underlying racism that is institutionalized in the United States, still exists, has existed for 400 years.
And yes, Biden said that, but he doesn't talk about history much that we could find. We look for more clips this afternoon. Dr. Blaine, want to react to any of those?
Well, the first thing that I would just say, just listening to Trump try to even talk about critical race theory or mention a 1619 project, I question whether he has even read the essays of the 1619 project. I really do question it, because if he's read the essays, maybe he would not be so quick to be essentially giving these talking points. And if he actually knew what critical race theory was and the impetus behind critical race theory in the first place, then perhaps he wouldn't be so quick to call it propaganda.
Joe in Burlington, you're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, Joe.
Hey there. Thanks so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say, I think one of the truths that we need to have as a country is that the experience of a white person in this country is fundamentally different from the experience of a non-white person in this country. And that's a function of generations of hangovers from our racist past. You know, and I hear people a lot of times say, slavery's over, get over it, Jim Crow's over, get over it. And the fact of the matter is, like, those things last for generations, and the repercussions of those systems persist today. And I think that's just a fundamental truth that needs to be shared in order to have this reckoning that things are fundamentally different for white people versus non-white people.
Thank you so much for that. Dr. Blaine, what do you think about that? What do you think about this idea that we have? We've talked a little bit about this already, but this idea that we just have two totally different, we have two totally different truths depending on whether you're white or non-white.
Yes, this is a persistent problem, and it's partly why I just continue to keep pushing forward with the work that I do, because I do worry about the narratives we tell. I worry that, you know, if I'm not writing this history, if other historians are not writing these histories, we'll find ourselves at a moment where people will literally, and we've already started, where people will literally say slavery did not exist in the United States. We can today talk about it and say, oh, that's preposterous. No one will say that. But where are we headed here? If we're not going to be straight up and be honest about the history, if we're not going to acknowledge the decades, the centuries of white supremacy and how it has shaped this nation, we are not that far removed from being at a place where people run around saying, no, that thing called slavery, what was it? Didn't happen. And being complete denial. So I'm committed to pushing the truth of this history that make people uncomfortable, because I think that's the only way we could move forward.
Dr. Keisha Blaine is a University of Pittsburgh history professor and president of the African American Intellectual History Society and co-editor with Ibram X. Kendi of the forthcoming book, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. Kai is one of the contributors to that book. And I will just say, I can't wait to read it, and I love the format and can't wait to see how you have chopped up 400 years of American history into 85-year pieces, perfect for American attention spans these days.
Yes.
So, Dr. Blaine, thank you so, so much.
Thanks for having me.
National reconciliation doesn't mean everyone smiles and all is forgiven. When you reconcile a financial statement, for instance, you determine who owes what to whom and where the money actually goes.
So we want to ask, who does owe what to whom to approach real racial equality, real racial justice in America? And in the context of the presidential race, what are the Trump and Biden approaches to looking our debts in the eye and making a larger reconciliation possible? Do they even both have any?
And as we take your calls, we are going to be joined by Barbara Smith, who has both chronicled and participated in some of the most important moments in our country's history with racism and the fight for racial justice. She is a Black feminist scholar and co-founder of the Combahee River Collective. In 2005, she was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Barbara, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
I'm glad to be with you.
And so you have written two striking essays lately, first in the Boston Globe and then in The Nation magazine, where you call for a sort of Marshall Plan for ending systemic white supremacy. You call it the Hammer-Baker Plan, named after Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker. But first off, one point you make is that people aren't even clear what these words mean, what the words systemic white supremacy means. So what do you mean by that phrase?
Well, I think that's a great place to start. Systemic white supremacy is the engine that really runs much of what happens on a daily basis here in the United States, and it doesn't have malice and aforethought necessarily. People hear white supremacy and they think that it refers to organized hate groups, people doing hate crimes, Knight Riders, Ku Klux Klan members, etc. But white supremacy is that system that does maintain vast wealth inequality, that does maintain redlining, whether the person who you see at the bank where you try to get that mortgage likes people of color or not, it's just built in or baked in. So systemic white supremacy, some people use the term systemic racism. It's those inequalities, that discrimination, that oppression that is just so pro forma. It's really, really difficult to get to unless you have a really big initiative like a Marshall Plan.
And why is that language important? You say it's an important thing to say systemic white supremacy and not something else. That's part of the plan. Why, if some people hear it and don't know what it means, or some people hear it and it turns them off, why do you think it's important to use those words?
I think it's important to use the term white supremacy because it indicates that it's a system of power. When you say systemic racism, it sounds like, yeah, it's everywhere, it's big, it's happening a lot, but it doesn't necessarily immediately say to the person who hears the term, and it's enforced by a power structure. When you say white supremacy, you begin to get to that issue of differential power, and why is this happening, and who does it benefit?
Let's take a phone call. Here's Elle in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Elle.
Hi.
Hi there. You're on America. Are We Ready?
Hello. I would like to have my presidential candidate or my future president to talk about seriously considering reparations for people of color and black people specifically who built this country. I'm 27. I'm black. My great-great-great-grandmother was a slave. And though my family has been one of the families who've pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, like people say, it's not a common thing for us. It's not as common as people would think it is, just because we have a lot of black entertainers and stuff like that. That is not a common thing. So I wish people would get rid of the narrative that if they just work super hard, you know, they'll be rich or they'll be as great and better off as our white counterparts, when that's just simply not the case. We need additional help, and it's owed to us because we built the country for it. We paid for everything.
Reparations means different things to different people. What does it mean to you?
I would like to see, for the value of what my family contribute to this country and for the people who benefited from that, I would like to see a dollar amount given to my family and to all the other families who have the same stories, who had slaves in their families. Because it gives an it gives us an opportunity to create the generational wealth that you were talking about in the first half of the show, or if we just simply feel like we are just unsafe and we just cannot be in this country anymore, because a lot of people are saying, go back to Africa, even though born in us, it gives us the opportunity to say, okay, you don't like me, fine, pay me what you owe me, and I will gladly leave and find somewhere who will appreciate me.
Elle, thank you so much. And Barbara Smith, your Hamer-Baker plan, your Marshall Plan, isn't built around reparations per se, though you write in The Nation that we could consider those as a part of it, perhaps. So what's the difference between what Elle is saying and what you're proposing?
I think that reparations is so complicated in the United States for many, many reasons. And I think that in order to really come up with some good solutions, that there needs to be people who have expertise and the means to analyze what would be near to fair. I don't know that it will be absolutely fair, because the person who just spoke, Elle, she knew exactly where her enslavement happened in her family. She mentioned a great-great-great-grandmother. I have the number of greats. I think I said the right number. But not everyone can do that. And it's really, as I said, it's challenging. I believe that there has been legislation in the House of Representatives from time out of mind. I think it was John Conyers, Representative John Conyers, who introduced it many decades ago, to have a committee or a body of Congress investigate reparations, not to give reparations willy-nilly, but at least to have a governmental body to examine and investigate the issue. And that's how I think that would go. I would not presume to say what the outcome would be. Sometimes people, when they talk about reparations now, they are talking about not necessarily dollars paid to individuals, but vast resources, monetary resources, poured into underserved communities. So it has a lot of possibilities, but it certainly is something that should be considered.
James in Lexington, Kentucky, you're on America, Are We Ready? Hi, James.
How are you today? My feeling is that we're never going to get anywhere until the government, the president's policies or whatever else, begins to hold police officers accountable for the small things that they break within society. I mean, when's the last time you saw a police car buzz past you, past the speed of the speed limit, but you would be really freaked out if a garbage truck blew past you, past the speed limit?
Well,
and so it's those small things that lead to that culture of elitism, that I'm allowed to do this because this is my job. I'm putting myself on the line, and so I should be allowed to do this.
Let me drill down on the presidential and vice presidential candidates and how they talk very differently about systemic racism or white supremacy or white privilege. Here's President Trump from those Bob Woodward interview tapes. Listen to the answer after Woodward asks him about his own white privilege.
Do you have any sense that that privilege has isolated and put you in a cave to a certain extent? Is it put me, and I think lots of white privileged people, in a cave, and that we have to work our way out of it to understand the anger and the pain particularly black people feel in this country?
Do you you really drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you? Listen to you. Wow. No, I don't feel that at all.
Believing you have white privilege is drinking the Kool-Aid. And Vice President Pence at the Republican convention uses Joe Biden stating that there is systemic racism as kind of an accusation against Biden. Listen.
Now, Joe Biden says that America is systemically racist and that law enforcement in America has, and I quote, an implicit bias against minorities.
At the Republican convention. By contrast, here's Kamala Harris on NPR giving one example of the consequences of one form of systemic inequality and the need for policy to intervene as she sees it.
You can look at the issue of untreated and undiagnosed trauma. African Americans have higher rates of heart disease and high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. It is environmental. It is centuries of slavery, which was a form of violence where women were raped, where children were taken from their parents. Violence associated with slavery. And that there was never any real intervention to break up what had been generations of people experiencing the highest forms of trauma. And trauma undiagnosed and untreated leads to physiological outcomes.
We're talking about the same thing as post-traumatic stress from a war. That's
sure,
the kind of thing we're talking about.
Absolutely. But listen, unless there's intervention done, it will appear to be perhaps generational, but it's generational only because the environment has not experienced a significant enough change to reverse the symptoms. You need to put resources and direct resources, extra resources, into those communities that have experienced that trauma.
And finally, after hearing the two vice presidential candidates sound so different from each other, here's Biden on a piece of systemic racism that he cites from the criminal justice system that becomes economic.
We're also going to have to remove another piece of systemic barrier for too many black and brown Americans. What's holding back too many people of color from finding a good job and starting a business is a criminal record that follows them every step of the way. Getting caught for smoking marijuana when you're young surely shouldn't deny you the rest of your life being able to have a good paying job or a career or a loan or the ability to rent an apartment. But right now, that criminal record is the weight that holds back too many people of color.
So we can say, Barbara Smith, that people certainly have a choice this year, and compare and contrast.
Well, I just want to get back to 45. I usually don't call him by his name, but the fact that he said to Bob Woodward that Bob Woodward had drunk the Kool-Aid because he actually believed that there was such a thing as white skin privilege. This is the same guy who doesn't ask God for forgiveness. So it's kind of all of a piece, it seems to me.
Let's go to Muhammad in Raleigh, North Carolina. Muhammad, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. So I'll try to be brief. So I have just 2 points. Number one is that when we talk about reparation, so this problem is an ongoing problem, right? So when we talk about reparation, and if we, let's say, come out with a dollar value and hypothetically we pay it out, the problem is not solved, right? It's not even half solved because it's an ongoing thing. If we come up with a number and then, let's say, hypothetically pay it out, somebody would say that, okay, this is done. We have solved this problem, which is not the case, right? So that's one point that I'd like to mention. Mm-hmm. My second point would be that as an engineer by profession, as a problem solver, anytime I come up with a very unique problem, I try to see that if a similar problem has been solved by anyone else. So I'd like to know that if there's any research where I know this is a uniquely American problem, but still, if something similar has been tried in other parts of the world successfully or unsuccessfully, and if we can learn anything from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Mark in Phoenix. Mark, you're on America, Are We Ready? Hi there.
Hi there, Brian. Great program, a really important program, so thank you for putting it on. Got input on two topics that came up The first one is on the reparations. I think I certainly agree with systemic racism. I mean, that's just factually there. The data shows it everywhere you look for it. But I think reparations for past acts, especially historically past acts, is something to be very careful about, because it's, I guess the easiest way to put it is man's inhumanity on man is legend. There really is no end to trying to undo that. After you get done with one, you go back to the Native Americans, and then you go back to the subjugation of women, which is long before the black slave trade in colonialism. So what I think, as I look at the conversation, I think as you do too, you'll see that most of the issues focus around current disparities. And I think that's the most fruitful place to focus, because that's what needs to get corrected. I don't think there's any amount of money that would bring back an ancient family member who was enslaved. But there are income gaps, there are wealth gaps, and there are justice gaps that are identifiable. And I think if the commission, or you formed a commission to focus on those gaps in groups, blacks for now, because they're the most aggrieved and most clearly needing reparation. But it would be, if there's a wealth gap in a group of people, then allocate money to close that wealth gap. You know, what's the difference? Great. Allocate that cash to everybody and do that on an annual or a five-year basis. After that's done and you find there are no discrepancies between blacks and whites, great. The other thing, so the main thing there is focus on what the gaps are and address those, because that's the real issue. The second thing was on the black shootings, and that's another one where just far too many blacks are being shot, and it's just black and white. Justice for blacks is very different than justice for whites. And I would really suggest looking at a model of the FAA and the NTSB. The NTSB investigates every single aviation and vehicle or transportation crash in the United States, regardless, and produces a report, tries to be as subjective as possible, saying here were the causes and here are things that should change in order to keep this from happening in the future. And I think forming a federal organization that simply and objectively investigated every single killing by a police officer, we'll find that most of them are probably justified. At least I certainly hope that's the case. But the investigation shouldn't be resisted by the police. And the investigation is going to find what needs to change to make sure that this doesn't happen, which generally I think everybody would agree, it's not a good thing to have cops killing people. Even cops don't like doing that.
Mark, thank you so much for that input. Barbara Smith, he had two big topics there. You want to comment on the first one? Because it may not be the ultimate system. People could debate that, but he had a system there for cash transfer over a period of 5 years to start to even out the bottom line, so people could go forward on a more level playing field.
Right. And we've talked a lot tonight about the issue of reparations. There's one sentence in my article about reparations. It's not a reparations plan.
Right, but that's what people latch on to. You know, it's interesting. That's the word that people know.
Yes, and the thing is, like, I talk about such things as quality education, universal access to quality health care, housing, paid family leave, high-quality child care, all kinds of things that would begin to address the great gaps that we see in the socioeconomic conditions between people of color and people who are white. And I think that that's just something that I really want to make sure that people understand, that this is not about reparations solely, and also it's not about who owes what to whom. I'm really writing about justice, and justice actually benefits everyone. So if we have a just society, that benefits everyone. It's not like a zero sum, you get some and I get less. It's really about what kind of society do we want to live in.
It's interesting. I mean, why do you think it's the case? And maybe it's about the way we frame the night. But so often when you have a conversation like this and you say, okay, let's talk about truth and reconciliation, let's talk about thinking about how we resolve the issues, it goes to people hear reparations and goes to reparations. So why do you think that's the case? And what does that say?
I don't think there's anything wrong with having that discussion. It's just that it wasn't what I was proposing that people think about. Like the Marshall Plan, the original Marshall Plan after World War II to bring Europe back from such great devastation, economic devastation, physical infrastructure devastation, governments disrupted because of World War II. That was not solely a reparations plan. Mm. That was like, let's rebuild societies and cultures and countries that have been very much devastated by the results of a major war. So that's, you know, the kind of thinking that I was trying to do, like big picture thinking around a lot of issues, not just focusing on dollar amounts being transferred from one bank to another.
Right.
You know,
and let's rebuild them because it's good. It was a good idea for the world to rebuild Europe, right? Like, that's the point. Is this
absolutely
was this was a positive?
Absolutely.
Term.
Autumn in Brooklyn, you're on America. Are We Ready? Hello, Autumn.
Hi. Thank you all for having this conversation in this very important moment. What I want to talk about in terms of reparation is how I see it as multifaceted. That while yes, there needs to be monetary money, I believe, being given back to direct descendants that were, you know, in the African slave trade and brought to America, I think that there's also a need to look at how we give reparations back to indigenous populations and giving stewardship back to them in terms of the land. And I think if we look at California right now, we can see that taking stewardship away from the indigenous population there and good burning has caused, you know, mass fires that are out of control. And there's just like so many facets to what we should be doing and what we could be doing. And I think another side of it is in the political realm, our politicians don't serve our people. They serve their big donors who keep getting them elected. And so there is money for them to not do what's right. This to not be passing comprehensive immigration reform, to not be passing laws that could be giving these type of reparations, either monetary or programs and money filing the programs into Black and brown communities. There's no incentive for them to do that, right? And big money and big donors want them to not pass that type of stuff because there's money to keep people in a lower class. There's money.
And Autumn, I'm going to jump in here only because the show's about to end and I want Barbara Smith to have a chance to respond to your comment at least briefly, because at very least, Barbara, and I know it's in your article, you do refer to indigenous people in your pieces. That's the other massive injustice in American history. Can there be a similar plan for them, or where do they come in the big picture as you see it?
Well, I think that the beauty of the kind of thinking and the kind of plan that I'm envisioning is that it is all-encompassing. One of the things I say is that if we were to really fully implement the kinds of ideas and suggestions that I am proposing, and it's not just me. This is like the template, you know. I'm just like the first, you know, like patient one or whatever. This is like has to be a big collective group of people figuring this out. But if we were to begin to do full implementation, it would mean we would have the kind of robust social safety net that would help everyone that we've never had in the nation before. So, yes, it is for everyone. And I also mentioned Latinx people, too. It's for all of us.
And even for white people. And that's another part of her Boston Globe and Nation articles worth reading about, why Barbara Smith argues that everyone, including white people specifically, will have freedom from the terror and hypocrisy that poisons life on both sides of the color line, as she puts it. And so you'll have to read her Boston Globe or Nation article to find out more about that. Barbara, thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much, Brian and Kai.
Brian Lehrer, A Daily Politics Podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.